Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melody Bettinelli.
We've got the laugh. Our adventures near and far. We have a little fewer adventures right now. Can we just go back to normal?
Yeah.
So let's pick up from where we left off. So last time, I think we hadn't had the plumbers do their work yet at our house.
I think, yeah.
If you're just joining us, we've been unable to live in our home for the past 6 weeks. More, actually, I think at this point. I think 7 weeks now.
It's almost 2 full months.
It's almost 2 full months. We had a water leak in our house. We had 2 leaks. We had a drain leak, the shower drain leaked, and we had a water leak under the bathroom sink in the slab. Our house is a slab, doesn't have a basement, and the water pipes used to go through the slab. Now they go through pipes that are near the ceiling of the rooms. It's kind of a long story. Maybe we'll go over that at some other point. But the plumbers finally came. They finally did their work. And we were hoping to be back in our house by the end of this week. This is the week before Thanksgiving. But the contractor says, no. So he says, how about another week? So we are going to be not in our home for another week. But unfortunately, we can't stay in this very nice rental that we've been renting in Plymouth, Mass. We're going to have to... I found another rental house that's in the next town over from ours. So that's nice. And we'll be moving there on Sunday for a week over Thanksgiving. It's going to be nice to be closer to home, to the house.
Yes.
But I think because the kids will be able to go to scouts and we'll be able to get back into some routines, we'll be able to go to our own parish. But you're going to miss this, Melanie.
I'm going to miss the beach very much. It's been nice. It's been at least if we have to be homeless, being homeless in a pretty place where there's stuff to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's that's been good.
I mean, you've been really taking advantage of the opportunity to walk on the beach every day.
You know, I do not get nearly enough exercise as a rule, and having the beach just like right there. On days when, like, if we were at home, I would not be going out on a walk on a day like today. It was chilly. It was not, like, great walking weather. But, you know, there's a beach right there.
Right.
And, I'm not the only one. There are people on the beach. You know, some of them are walking their dogs. Some of them are older people hobbling along with canes. But there's something about, like... the beach that draws you.
There's a definite beach culture and different beach cultures in different places. Like in places that are warm year round, there's a certain kind of beach culture there, but there's a beach culture in a place that has seasons like we do too. Like in the summer it's hot and it's crowded, but as the weather turns, the beach still has an attraction. It's cold and you have to bundle up and it's hard to stick around in the cold, you know, cold winds, but there's still something about the beach.
Yeah. I mean, when we were on Cape Cod, even at the, you know, end of September, there were like lots of people camped out on the beach with like, you know, blankets and
like it was summer
and
and swimming and
but wrapped up in blankets and sweatshirts.
Right. There were people. Yes, there were people. Right.
Like, it's cold enough that we're wrapped up in blankets, but we're still, like, going to the beach.
We still want to be at the beach. There's something about being near the ocean that, yeah. And because at home, what do we have? We have a suburban neighborhood. You can walk among all the homes. There's a couple of parks.
Right. I mean, I've walked around our neighborhood.
A million times.
I could probably do it blindfolded at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, so there's the town forest. There's the state park. In the state park is nice, but we've kind of walked as far as the kids will let us walk in there. Like, we get to a certain point and they're all like, yeah, can we go back now?
I know. I never get to get past the point.
Around that corner. What's around that corner? There's something there. So, yeah. So, yeah, it's a little bittersweet. I mean, all of us are kind of ready to go home, but there's still a part of us that wants to... I mean, I won't be sad about losing the 45-minute drive back and forth. But, yeah, I know, I can tell that you're sad about losing the...
I'm sad.
About losing the beach. Well, and the other thing that we've taken advantage of... is, I just kicked the box into the desk. The other thing we're sad about... losing is we're being in Plymouth around Thanksgiving. We went to Plymouth Plantation, although it is no longer called Plymouth Plantation.
It's now Plymouth Patuxent.
Plymouth Patuxent. They said one of the interpreters working there was saying that, well, I don't know, it wasn't an interpreter. Guide, I guess. Yeah, docent would be a museum. But was saying that they changed the name because people were... Would say things like, so Plymouth Plantation, where did the slaves live? Because there's this association, I guess, in a lot of people's minds that a plantation is a place where that owned slaves, which is not true. That by definition, a plantation is a place where things are planted.
Right.
It's a very large farm, you know, or a collection of farms. But the times being what they are, and Patuxent is the native name for the area before the Pilgrims came, it was called Patuxent. So there's an acknowledgement of the native peoples.
Right. And that fits the site, too, because the site, it has the 17th century English village with the little wooden cottages with the thatched roofs, which were a recreation of what the Pilgrims would have built when they came here. But it also has a Wampanoag village with... both a summer and winter Wetu, which are the...
Yeah, people might call them wigwams or teepees, but the Wampanoag word is Wetu.
Yeah. Not wigwam.
Not wigwam. So that's the first place we went to, was the Wampanoag village. And we went into they have the winter Wetu, which is big enough. It's like a longhouse. It's very big. You would fit many people in it. You could fit several dozen people in it. And they had furs, animal furs, and they had examples of the various crafts and things that they would make.
It was really cool. I mean, they you sit on a raised bench that goes around, you know, down both sides, and
the bench is covered in the furs.
Right. It was very cozy. And there's a fire going in the middle of it, and the interpreter was really very friendly and knowledgeable, and she was working on making a knotted bag.
Yes.
Like a woven bag.
A pocket, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. My sense was that the interpreters in that area were people who are themselves of Wampanoag heritage. Like, at least the two people, like those, the woman that was in the Wetu and the woman that was in the cooking area, both spoke as if this was their heritage. So, which is interesting. There's a lot of people with Wampanoag heritage in the area.
Right.
Maybe, you know, small percentages, you know, 1/16th or something like that, but they're still heritage. But it was interesting talking to them. I thought it was fascinating talking to the woman in the cooking area and talking about the different ways that they would eat and the things that they would eat and how they had a good relationship with the Pilgrims. They were friendly and they were also making... what was the word? Not canoe. That's not a Wampanoag word, but Mashuna?
I do not remember the.
Yeah, there's another word, but it was like basically a very large dugout canoe that you make by burning the interior out, which was
cool. They were actively burning it with fire. Mm-hmm. Though they only had a couple people working on it, so they explained that the Wampanoags would have had a bunch of people working on it all at once, and the process would have gone much faster.
Right.
Like, they would have been burning out the whole thing at one go instead of, like, little teeny bits and pieces.
I've seen that process being done on the Townsend's channel, the 18th century reenactor.
Uh-huh.
He made a dugout canoe like that, which is pretty cool. So then from there, we went over to the village, the Plymouth village, and there's the first is the blockhouse. So it's the... It would have doubled as both church and as defensive point.
Fort. There's cannons on the top.
Yeah. And there was a guy up there talking about the, you know, like an older guy, probably a local who was volunteering, you know, who's a history buff. I mean, you always see that at these different places, these historical sites. There's always like these volunteers who are just historical buffs who come and want to talk to people about.
I think it's awesome. I mean, what a great thing to do. Like, you're retired. You just stand around and talk to people about history all day. I can see, like, you doing that.
Yeah, that would be fun. It was funny. At one point, you were talking about the things that they would eat, and he turns to Anthony and he says, "Have you ever had eel?" Like, and he's expecting Anthony to recoil in disgust. And Anthony goes, "Yeah." And he was taken aback, like, "Really?" And I had to say, "Well, sushi." He's had unagi. He's like, "Oh yeah, I don't like sushi."
No, he said sushi. Wow, you're really brave.
Oh right, something like that. Yeah, so that was fun. And then we go into the village, and one of the things about the village to keep that, you know, you have to understand is there are people who are dressed up in the interpreters. And they are inhabiting a personality, a real person from the village.
Right. So they laid out the village in the way it would have been laid out in the 17th century.
With fewer homes.
Fewer homes. They only built the homes where they were absolutely sure of the names of the family involved. So there is Miles Standish home, and the woman who is portraying his wife is there, and she's talking about, you know, "My husband does this and my husband does that." And
they'd be doing the chores of the house.
Yeah. In Miles Standish's home, they were making, turnips.
Right. And then we ran into, Edward Winslow's wife, Susanna, and she was funny. She was in the garden and she was a hoot. Yeah. She was a lot of fun talking about the different,
herbs
and plants. Yeah. The what was she growing? She had radishes. Like, even as late as November, they had radishes in the ground, and they had chard,
yeah,
parsley and sage and a bunch of other things. And of course, like kids, there were several field trips there, a lot of little kids there. Kids, I don't know, there's this impulse to kind of catch out these people who are play acting. And it's like, and she would say, "Well, do you have a garden? What do you grow in your garden?" A kid would say, "Tomatoes." "Tomatoes? Those I've heard are deadly." "What? You're crazy, lady." You know, the kids were kind of like sassy.
They were sassy.
Yeah. And, but I remember that. So I remember going to Plymouth Plantation when I was a kid, when I was, you know, 8, 9, 10. And seeing these people doing the interpreting, it was kind of weird. It was like, because there's this uncomfortable acknowledgement that I know and you know that you're play acting, that you're not really this person. And so I have to kind of agree to be part of your game. And I'm kind of uncomfortable as an introvert with that. I mean, I try to enter into it, the moment, and sort of like, it's almost like role-playing games, but it did feel kind of awkward at times.
Yeah. I feel like if I were to go back again, I would want to go with a list of questions. Like, I feel like the people who are interpreting obviously have studied up. They know their character. They know their history. And they have stories to tell. And I feel like I was kind of squandering their time because I didn't know how to elicit the information that they had that I wanted to have.
You didn't know the right questions. Again, it's like D&D. Like, when you encounter a non-player character, the dungeon master has them stacked full of information if you can just ask the right questions.
Right. Like there was clearly a lot of information more information that we could have got from them if we had been able to, like, I don't know, take more time.
Well, there was also the distraction of all the little kids.
Right. So there was the distraction of the other people who are there, like the kids who are there on field trips from school. And then there's the sort of our kids not wanting to
linger in any
place. Too long for any one place. So there's that too. And then there's sort of the, like, not wanting to monopolize the interpreter when other people are waiting to have their turn. But I've heard that it can be a good strategy to kind of follow around behind somebody who's asking good questions and, like, just listen to the interpreter talk to them.
Right.
Unfortunately, I didn't find anybody who was going around asking good questions. So But even so, the bits and pieces that we got were really fascinating. There was one guy who was interpreting, I forget the person's...
The guy with the wood? The chopping wood? And he was letting the kids all take their turns chopping
wood? He was splitting logs and letting the kids take turns splitting the logs with these gigantic wooden mallets.
Yeah, mallet and wedge.
But he was also sort of telling a story while he was working. And the story he was interesting was actually much more interesting than the wood that he was splitting. And I just wanted him to stop, like, supervising the wood splitting and just tell his story. Because
right, about shipwreck
He kept starting and stopping different stories, and he never got to the end of any of them. It was like ADHD, man. Just stop. Just tell
one of them.
Finish a story.
Yes.
Just finish a story.
Well, I gather he was playing an old man, and it was right on character.
Jumping
from one story to the next.
Right. There were, that was one of the interesting things. The reenactors weren't always the same age as the characters they were playing, which I think if they had more employees, they would probably have had
maybe five people.
There weren't, right. I felt like they were very short staffed.
Yeah, it wasn't.
In both the Wampanoag Village and the 17th century English village.
A lot of museums are short-staffed after COVID. They had to lay off a lot of people.
So I feel like we didn't get the fullest experience possible because we were going sort of post-COVID in this, like, more limited.
Yeah, and yet it's the week before Thanksgiving, you know, or 2 weeks before Thanksgiving. You'd think they would be busier. Than they were, so.
Yeah, they were not nearly as busy. I was worried because, like, it's so close to Thanksgiving, and November is the busiest month at Plymouth Plantation. And so I was a little bit worried that it was going to be swamped, and it wasn't. So that was kind of pleasant in a way. Although, maybe if they were more swamped, there would have been more interpreters, and it would have been
so
more lively.
One of the things that we got to participate in was they had the militia drill.
That was so cool. Yeah. So they had pike drill. Like, their militia carried pikes.
Long spears.
Very long spears.
Yes.
And so they had a bunch of kids come and they drilled them. Like, they taught them how to hold it, how to march with
it. How to do the orders, you know, order arms, at ease, you know, how to march, and then how to charge with it. So the kids got different kinds of sticks according to their age and height. So, like, Bella was in there, and she had a real pike. She had
anybody over 14 could have the real long pike.
It was like 12 feet long. It was really tall.
It was big. It was huge.
Yeah, and then younger kids would just get, like, a pole, like a short 3 foot blunt pole. But they were very serious.
Safer.
Yes, and they were very serious about having, you know, you have to do everything as we said, or you'll be dismissed from the formation. You know, no swinging the pole around. The pole has to be where we tell you to put it at all times.
And the kids were generally pretty good at following directions, I have to say.
Yeah, and so it was Bella and Lucy and Anthony were all in formation.
Yeah, the other two didn't jump in quickly enough.
And Anthony took it very seriously.
He was very at
attention. So it was really good. And then and the two guys doing the drilling, you know, the being in charge, the captain and the lieutenant, were interpreters. So they were in character, and they ended with a prayer.
That was really nice. You know, because I think that a lot of modern people are uncomfortable with prayer, I was almost surprised. And he was, when they were doing the battle cries, too, actually.
For Jesus Christ victorious?
Jesus Christ, our Savior.
Our victor.
Our Savior.
A Savior, yeah, or something. But there was victory was in it somewhere.
He was calling Jesus Christ. He wasn't actually having the kids say the name of Jesus, which was, I think, a smart move on their part. They were like, for Jesus Christ, victory, and the kids would yell, victory!
Right, that's what it was. Yeah.
Which was good. I mean, you don't want to put people who are non-Christian into a position where they're uncomfortable.
Right.
Like,
that would be...
But he did pray at the end of it. He said, you know, you can bow your heads or take whatever position is comfortable. But he knelt down and he said an actual real
thank you, Lord, that no one was maimed prayer. Or killed in our drill. I thought that was funny.
Yeah, it was really good. The whole Plymouth Plantation thing was a lot I wasn't sure what to expect, and I'm not 100% comfortable, like you were talking about, with the living history playing pretend thing. But I found myself really wanting to go back again. Like, mm-hmm. I would love to go back again.
Yeah. So it took us about, what, 3 hours?
Yeah, and we could have stayed longer.
Yeah. So there was an exhibit in the main building for the archaeology exhibit we could have spent some time at, which we didn't. We also had lunch there. It's not inexpensive, especially for a family of seven.
Yeah.
We got a discount pass through the local library.
Right. This would have been a lot more expensive without the discount pass was almost
half off.
Half off.
It was still over $100 for the seven of us. Yeah.
But yeah, not too bad. And the discount and the pass got us into both Plymouth Plantation and the Mayflower. And also there's a third site, a grist mill, which.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
we could have gone to as well.
Right. So just to wrap up with the Plymouth Plantation itself, we ended up. Hungry children. We got there. We could have got there earlier, which actually we got there kind of a little early. But getting there earlier would have avoided some of the field trip stuff nonsense craziness. Right. But nevertheless, we were there for about 3 hours, and we stopped and had some lunch, and then went from there, and we went to downtown Plymouth to the harbor. The thing is, Plymouth Plantation is like right. In the town, it's like it's literally was like 15 minutes from our front door, maybe right. less even, maybe 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, Plymouth is kind of a spread out town.
It's a very large town, but most of the population is clustered in two small areas.
Right, with wooded areas and wildland in between.
Yeah,
parts of the town.
It's like by area, it's one of the biggest towns in the state. But it's. Yeah, it's very much clustered. So Plymouth Plantation itself is close to downtown, and then there's the Mayflower 2, which is a reproduction that's downtown. We actually saw Mayflower 2 last year in... A couple years ago in Mystic, Connecticut, at the Mystic Seaport, where she was being reconstructed. Basically, what did he say? The guy said it was like
80%
of it is new wood.
Of the wood it was replaced.
At what point? What is it? The famous Theseus's the ship of Theseus. If you replace everything but the keel, and then later on you replace the keel, is it still the ship of Theseus?
Right, or my father's axe, or it's an interesting philosophical question. Like, at what point is it still the same ship? If you replace gradually all the wood over time.
Yes.
Then again, our bodies are the same way.
Right, exactly. So we went down to that because it was included, and we went on board. They have a nice little interpretive area before you get on with some various things, and they encourage you to kind of take on
They assign you a character as you when you get your ticket.
Right. And they give you a little backstory.
So our character was a woman who had joined the pilgrims in Leiden in the Netherlands.
Right.
And so you were supposed to, as you sort of went through, think about things from the point of view of that particular person. Like, what would they be thinking? What would they be feeling? I felt like that was kind of lost on most of the kids who were going through the exhibit. But it was an interesting invitation, at least.
Yeah.
Even if most people don't take them up on it. They did invite you to really ponder and think about what it would be like for a particular person.
Yeah. And the ship itself is nice. It's small. I mean, if you ever go on board, if you've ever been on any old sailing ships, The Mayflower, like compared to say like the Constitution or the Charles Morgan, the whaling ship in Mystic, or
it's kind of a horrifically small ship.
Yes, considering the number of people that they jammed into there for months at a time on the sea voyage, and even then, like the first deck below decks is where most of the pilgrims were, and the ceiling, like it's got to be a 6 foot between the decks.
Uh huh.
Yeah, that's not how much room they had. They had 5 feet. Yeah, they've made it bigger for modern people. So that was interesting. And then just to see the conditions, and we got to go into what would have been the master's cabin, which is the captain's cabin, where the officers would have been. And you go up to, and then they have like this modern cockpit where they have the navigational equipment and stuff like that. So it was really cool. I mean, it's a big deal because last year, 2020, was the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims landing in Plymouth. And that whole celebration kind of got short-circuited by COVID, and they didn't get to have all of the celebrations.
Yeah, it was kind of sad.
Yeah, but it's kind of cool to go and see, you know, yeah, this is 400 years.
I did think that the ship wasn't interpreted as well as it could have been. Like, you know, having been to Mystic Seaport, there was a lot of really great information about the ships.
Yeah.
And there was a lot more, like, attempt to make it feel like the ship would have been at that time. And I felt like the Mayflower wasn't as much as I expected in terms of making it feel like a 17th century ship.
Like interpretive signage and other things, yeah.
Right.
They didn't have, like, the cots or the living spaces set up or stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, I was surprised. I really expected them to have things more set up so that you could see more what it would be have been like for the
pilgrims
yeah. in the hold.
Yeah.
They had the master's cabin set up with a table in it and a few things on the table.
Hardly set up. There was a few dinner
plates. Yeah, it was not...
You know, the captain's chest wasn't there. They didn't have a bed out for him. You know, like, it was...
Yeah, there were
like,
no beds or bunks anywhere.
Yeah. So they could have done more with that, I think.
And maybe they had planned to, and that got short-circuited because of COVID, too, or something. But I felt like...
Yeah.
There were opportunities that could have... That were missed.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
It was still cool. But compared to, like, the other ships that we've seen, like, at Mystic Seaport... The Mayflower was something of a disappointment.
Or my very favorite ship of all time, which is the Constitution.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true. So it was overall. And of course, not to forget Plymouth Rock, which is a rock in a portico.
It's a rock.
It's just a rock. Well, although it was cool, there was a park ranger there who was telling a story to these people that were about how we've got this story of Plymouth Rock. Like, why is this rock of any significance? And it turns out it came out of the story.
It was a sermon.
Just before the Revolution.
It was before the Civil War.
Was it really?
Yes, it was Civil War era. And so it was a lot about the Northern sort of pride in history of, like, we are the real first settlement.
As opposed to Jamestown.
So it was a sort of Northern pride versus, like...
And this sermon kind of incorporated this idea of them stepping out upon this rock of the New World from the ship.
Right. And so then at some point, some people...
Identified a rock.
There's like a Friends of the Founders organization.
Right.
Is that what they were called? I can't remember.
Something like that. But, so there was a Founders Day holiday long before Thanksgiving. So Thanksgiving was... The first Thanksgiving was Abraham Lincoln. The holiday, first of Thanksgiving holiday was Abraham Lincoln. But before that, there was a Founders Day that commemorated in Plymouth.
Plymouth had their own celebration that they'd been celebrating for a long time.
Hundreds of years. Yeah.
Right. A Founders Day to celebrate when the pilgrims landed in Plymouth.
So this homily, the sermon was given on a Founders Day just before the Civil War.
Right.
And incorporated the whole mythology of the rock. So it was interesting. It was kind of cool. To see it. I mean, but like for most people, they go, they see, well, it's a rock. Thank you. Gentlemen, welcome to the rock. If I were the interpreter, that's what I would totally be doing, like my Sean Connery welcome to the rock Alcatraz thing.
Sure.
No one would get it except old guys like me.
Right.
Who remember the old movie.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this is my unimpressed.
Yes.
So one thing we've done in terms of homeschooling is homeschooling's kind of been very
spotty,
but I decided to try to do some, like, local history, local stories, and I picked up a book about the Mayflower by Nathaniel Philbrick, the historian.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a young reader's version of it, but it's a fairly recent book,
right?
And So it tells the story of the Mayflower, but not just the Mayflower. It also tells the story of the first like generation of Mayflower descendants up to and through King Philip's War, basically telling about sort of the peaceful settlement and then when the peace broke apart between the Pilgrims and the natives. And so we've been reading that, and that was really cool because the kids had really fresh in their minds a really well-written book about the Mayflower. And so when we went, it was really cool because we had just like been reading about it, and now here it is in front of us. And that really worked well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I can't always get field trips to line up with what we've been reading and doing in school. When it lines up really nicely like that, it's kind of exciting, and it worked.
Hmm. So, yeah, so that was good. It was worthwhile, and I'm glad we did it, definitely. We our first attempt to go was derailed by the nor'easter that knocked out power for days. But I'm glad we finally were able to get it in. So, speaking of homeschooling, we've been getting plenty of oceanography and biology.
Yes. It's been really cool. There's a little stream that runs into the beach here. And so we've been watching the erosion. Like, the storm basically filled up the entire stream with sand, and then they excavated it out. And it eroded a bunch of the dunes. And so we're able to, like, see how sandbars form from erosion. So that's been really cool. Just, like, a sort of natural geological formations.
And then there's a couple of freshwater brackish ponds.
Right. So there's a pond. As we're walking down to the beach from our house, we pass by this pond / marsh area where
it's full of birds.
Lots of birds. We saw a swan the other day when we were walking down to the beach, which was cool. One night when we were coming home from the beach right after sunset, we saw dozens of ducks coming to land for the night in the marsh, which was...
Right. That was really cool.
That was really awesome.
But also seeing, you know, cormorants and starlings and woodpeckers and, I mean, all the different kinds
of birds. Lots of
crows. Lots of crows. Yeah. So that's been really cool. But speaking of birds, we've been also finding bird skeletons on the beach.
Yeah, we suspect that some of this might have been exacerbated by the big storm. But we found the skeleton of a gannet. Not a skeleton. We found a dead bird in the walkway as you're going from the beach. And we're like, it was a big bird, like a swan-sized bird.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it. It's white feathers on its head, but it doesn't look like a gull. It's much too big for a gull. And it's got a long, skinny neck and a very, very long, pointy beak. And so I took pictures of it and posted them on Facebook because this is what one does, right? And a friend who is a science teacher and she taught Bella's ornithology class that she took, she helped us to identify it as a gannet. Which is a large seagoing bird that you don't usually see close to shore. Like, they're fishing birds who are out far.
Right.
So that was really cool. And then we also saw we found a skeleton, like a head and vertebrae of what we later identified as a cormorant.
Mm-hmm.
And then Anthony found this like really fascinating bone, and we're like, "What on earth is that?
Could it be like the top of a skull or a jaw?" But it had this big fin on it.
So we finally identified it as the sternum
keel bone
of a cormorant.
Yeah, that friend online gave us a link to some photos of comparing the keel bones of different seabirds, and it was clearly cormorant when we got to that.
Yeah. So now we're speculating that the head and neck that we saw probably belonged to the same individual as the sternum. So we've got now the sternum of a cormorant in our possession for the nonce while we are kind of investigating it. I suspect that it's probably the kind of thing that one isn't supposed to take.
I don't know. It's not like it's an endangered species.
Actually, the There's really strict regulations even on non-endangered species for
collecting their bones.
For bones, feathers, any body parts of birds.
Really?
Yeah.
That's annoying.
It is. For the naturalists it's, among us.
It's probably has to do with the feather trade.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those. I mean, that's really how the Audubon Society got started, was fighting the trade in feathers for women's hats.
Which decimated the bird population.
It did.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not opposed to that, but it is annoying to when you have some cool bones. So, anyway, but so we've been getting in
Did we talk about the dead seal in our last podcast?
Yes, we did talk about the dead seal.
So,
yeah. So we've been getting a lot of natural biology in.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, it's been a great opportunity. We've also, I feel like we've got a lot better handle on tides and
the natural rhythms of the ocean, how it changes from day to day.
Right. I mean, the kids are like, where should we go today? And if it's low tide, we can go down to the rocks and we can explore the tide pools where we can find hermit crabs and shrimp and all sorts of fun little creatures.
Sea worms and stuff, yeah.
But when the tide's high, those tidal pools are inaccessible. So we go the other direction to the stream where they can throw rocks into the stream.
Yep. So, yeah, that's been good. So let's move on, and we're going to talk about what we've been reading and watching, although more watching than reading. I don't think either of us have completed a book in the past week. We've got a new book that the whole family is reading, the new Star Wars Thrawn novel.
I haven't started it yet.
Yes, but that's everyone's all excited by that. That just came out today. But let me first talk about a movie I watched on Netflix called The Harder They Fall. It is a cowboy movie featuring African-American actors and characters. Idris Elba. I'm trying to think. I don't recognize the names of most of the others. His was the recognizable name. There was the... I'd have to pull it up. The... Delindo. I know his name, and it's at the tip of my tongue. Anyway... all of the characters are supposedly real people, and it's a fictionalized situation, real historical people.
Historical figures.
Yeah, it's about these two gangs and this one gangster who is so ruthless and terrible, and this other gang, the leader of that gang, he had murdered his parents, and so he wants revenge. It was okay. It was very stylized and sometimes a little on the nose. Like, they go to, like, there's the black town where it's mostly black people. This is an all takes place, I think, in Wyoming. And they go to the white town, and it's literally white. Like, the buildings are white. The sign that the in front of, like, on the angle from the camera, where the camera's positioned to overlook the town, you can see a sign for white flower. Like, it's literal, everything is literally white. It was kind of stylized, and it had some, like, modern music that went with it. So it was kind of interesting, very violent. But one of the funny things was like the romantic lead character, female lead character, was named Stagecoach Mary. Now, Stagecoach Mary is a real person. And in fact, she was the subject of an episode of the American Catholic History because she was Catholic. And like the Stagecoach Mary of this movie was slinky and sexy and, you know, a gangster's mall sort of person. And, like, the real Stagecoach Mary was, I mean, she was kind of crude and crass and would get into a brawl here and there. I mean, that part is true. But she was not slinky. She was, you know, not anybody's mall or girlfriend. In fact, she was, one of her best friends was the prioress of a Dominican prioress.
Hey, I don't remember what the order was.
But it was just kind of funny and weird that they took this person, this real person, and they just caricaturized her. Like that's not who she is. Like, are you honoring these people? Is that what you're trying to do? But you're not really if you're making something fake about them. It was kind of weird. So anyway, it was all right. I mean, it was, if you don't mind violent cowboy movies, It wasn't a bad movie. Idris Elba is always fun to watch. I mean, he's a really good actor, so I always enjoy anything he's in. So I watched that. I didn't write down, but I should have mentioned, I also watched this other new Netflix movie called Red Notice, which stars Ryan Reynolds, The Rock, and Gal Gadot, about art thieves and an FBI agent trying to recover Cleopatra's eggs. It was all right.
Okay.
It was, lots and lots of people watch it. It's pulp. It's, a little bit of a fun palate cleanser sort of popcorn movie. Nothing fantastic. Is there a museum in the Castel Sant'Angelo in Rome? I don't think there is. Because in the movie, they put a museum inside Castel Sant'Angelo.
There might be some sort of an interpretive.
No, an art museum.
But not an art museum.
No, they had an art museum in there. It was kind of funny. There was some funny, Ryan Reynolds is in it, so it's obviously going to have some funny, snarky stuff, some good action, so it was fun. Gal Gadot was in it. She's always interesting to look at. there was some good, funny stuff. Then you and I both watched the Marvel movie, Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings.
I loved it.
Yeah.
It was so fun.
I really liked it. I had to watch the last hour twice because I fell asleep. Yeah. The first half, I think the first half of the movie was better than the second half in many ways.
I agree. The setup was better than the big showy finale.
Well, the second half was all CGI battles and fights and a lot of that stuff, which is fine. I mean, I like a good battle between giant CGI monsters as much as anybody, but
maybe a little less than some people.
I mean, I got a little tired, but the first half where you're telling the story of the smaller story of how this guy is who he is and his friend and his father, who is, I really like the character of the father because you couldn't pigeonhole him.
Right. He was a great character.
Because on the one hand, he's a bad guy, but on the other hand, he wasn't,
Yeah.
He wasn't like, he wasn't just like this cardboard cutout of the bad guy dad who, or the, I don't know. It was really interesting to see them do something a little different there. So that was fun. His best friend,
Katie,
who is a sort of the audience analog. She's the audience stand-in. She's the person who sort of doesn't fit into this world and is along for the ride.
She was awesome.
Right. I think she got better as the character got better as the story went on. And I felt like she was kind of the romantic interest for Shang-Chi, but they didn't make her into this huge romantic interest.
Yeah. I liked that they left it as sort of ambiguous. Like, the beginning of the movie, her grandmother asks, when are you going to get married? And both of them laugh it off.
Like, yeah, we're just friends.
We're just friends. But there's some definite, interest there. But I like that they left it as, just they can be sort of mm-hmm. working this out. They don't have to have settled their,
right.
The nature of their relationship is.
There's some great cameo moments, especially in the post credits, but this so you have Benedict Wong, who is Wong from Doctor Strange, who was fun in that, but is in the Avengers movies, he's really fun in this. There's also in the post credits scenes is Ms. Marvel and Captain Marvel. Ms. Marvel is somebody else. There are two characters the literally two characters, Ms. Marvel and Captain Marvel. So that was Captain Marvel and Bruce Banner, the Hulk. They were there, but. Michelle Yeoh was in it. Michelle Yeoh was ageless, and she's always good in everything.
Yeah.
Trying to think of any other specific things. I don't know. I there was in modern, and I say modern, in the past, say, 30 years, most kung fu martial arts related movies have that fly-by-wire sort of martial arts stuff. Where they're flying through the air in physics-defying ways.
Right.
Sort of things. Which is kind of an interesting thing that kind of came out of Hong Kong with Jackie Chan. I think it was Jackie Chan. But anyway.
John Woo.
Right. You know, it's not like the Bruce Lee era stuff where it was still had improbable stuff happen, but it wasn't the same like graceful flying through the air, crouching tiger, hidden dragon sort of stuff. But this had it, but it wasn't over the top. You know, it just, it felt like both a martial arts movie, but a Marvel movie too.
Right. I liked the fusion. It was fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good fusion. Marvel movies have, there's a formula for a good Marvel movie.
Right.
Well, one, they're almost always about family.
And this one was no exception. Like the family stuff was good.
Yeah. It was for in the forefront. They also have plenty of action, but also peppered with plenty of humor.
Yes. Lots of good, funny, snappy, witty.
Like, you know, like in the bus fight scene, there's always going to be that guy on the bus with the kid, with the phone out, live streaming it.
that was fun.
Yeah, that was funny. In fact, I saw a really good Twitter thread today by a guy who actually drives a bus in San Francisco. So there's this fight scene that takes place on a city bus in San Francisco. And so he critiques all of the stuff on the bus. And, you know, for like, well, that is taking place on such and such street. It would have taken 40 minutes to get from the place we saw in the previous shot.
Right.
Is that sort of stuff. And he's like, oh, that bus driver is wearing his headphones while he's driving. That's a violation right there. You know, so that was a funny Twitter thread. One critique I heard mentioned that this, with a lot of Marvel movies, the stakes are too high. You know, they always have to go do, you know, it's saving. We have to save the universe. Whatever this threat is, it's a threat to the entire universe or the entire world. And there aren't enough smaller stories like Black Widow. The stakes were lower. You know, it was more immediate to, you know, we have to save ourselves.
Well, there was a little bit of a
people for assassination, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Which was nice to have some smaller movies like the. The Netflix
time,
Marvel series, Daredevil, Iron, what's his name? Cage, not Nick Cage. That's a whole different guy. Jessica Jones. They were smaller stories.
Luke Cage,
not Nick Cage. That's a whole different thing. That's Raising Arizona. Yeah, Luke Cage.
I have to say that I did think that, although the stakes were kind of high, there were also, I mean, in Black Widow, it was a more intimate feeling movie. It was very much about
again, their family. Yeah, it was very much an intimate movie about family relationships. I mean, so many Marvel movies are about family, about, you know, in Endgame. There was a lot about Tony Stark and his daughter,
right? You know,
and Tony Stark and his father also as well. You constantly have these familial themes throughout, which I think is part of their success, part of what makes them great. I'm trying to think of WandaVision had plenty of family themes in it. Like
right.
they made a family, but there was also her brother and her family at back home. Yeah. Family is a big part of it. And I think it's a big element in the success of the Marvel movies of why they're good. So Shang-Chi was good. I was pleasantly surprised, and I'm looking forward to the sequel, the further adventures of Shang-Chi. I think the actor Simu Liu, I think it was, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. I think he was good. I'd never seen him in anything before, and I think he was really good. So I'm looking forward to more. So, anything else?
Let's see.
I think that's about it for... Still watching Longmire. I'm watching Stargate SG-1.
I've been reading very, very slowly through a novel that's set in Revolutionary War era Maine,
mm-hmm.
called Arundel, which is not a recent novel at all. It's... but I picked it up at the library because it looked interesting.
follows a guy going with Benedict Arnold to Quebec, right?
Yeah, eventually we're going to get to Benedict. He's met Benedict Arnold, but he meets him when he's a young man. And so far we're like backstory, like pre-revolution, and we're just getting to the point now in the story where the Sons of Liberty are starting to kick up a ruckus and push for revolution. But that's a good quarter of the way into the novel.
Is Arundel his name?
No, Arundel's a town in Maine.
Right. That's what I was... I knew that.
His father owns a blacksmith shop and runs the ferry in Arundel, Maine. Okay. And then he dies, and the son is left to kind of take on the work of the blacksmith shop. And then he ends up owning a ship as well. And so he's kind of the big name in town.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he's not super committed to the revolution, but eventually he kind of gets caught up in it, I think. But it's not a quick read. It's not a fast moving book, and I keep wanting to put it down and find something that's a little bit quicker to read, and I'm tug of war with it.
I have the new Thrawn book that I want to read.
I've got that too.
And I've got a new Tom Clancy novel I want to read that just came out the same day.
I think Arundel's going to get put on the back burner while I finish Thrawn, and then I'll pick it back up again.
I might put the book I'm currently reading on the back burner too, because it's slow. I mean, I think I talked about it before, but I don't want to go over it again. But yeah. By the way, Arundel is basically Kennebunkport.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's where it is.
Yeah. Southern Maine, Kennebunkport. Their motto is where people matter.
Yeah. It's an interesting book. His father spends a lot of time with the native tribes, and in fact has a relationship with a native woman. And so there's a lot of really positive, I mean, a lot of the language that it uses would not be politically correct today.
Mm-hmm.
But the attitude is very positive towards the Abenaki people, and the main character's dad seems to actually kind of prefer the Indians to the white people. So, he spends a lot of time going on this long expedition to try to save a girl who's kidnapped by a French guy. The French guy's bad.
Yes.
We don't like the French. Except, of course, then they end up switching, because in the revolution, suddenly the French are our allies and we have to, like, pretend to like them, even though we've just fought the French and Indian War against them and don't like them very much.
Well, I mean, that was actually a big deal in the war.
That's actually something I don't think I'd really picked up on as strongly before in any books that I've read. Like, what a shift that was for going from fighting the French to... Wait, now our French are our allies against Britain?
Well, remember the Mel Gibson movie, The Patriot, which I talked about recently on Secrets of Movies and TV shows.
I saw that ages ago,
yeah.
I suppose.
There was the French guy who was helping Mel Gibson's character, who had some resentment against him because Mel Gibson's guy was particularly effective against the French in the French and Indian War. So there was some lingering resentment there. But you know, it was a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend now, and so we're now friends. And then, of course, they became close by the end, but yeah. Well, it sounds good. Long, but good.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's nice to have an occasional longer, long-form historical fiction. It's just my attention span isn't great.
So, I think we were going to keep it shorter. I don't think we did.
Of course not.
But I think we should probably wrap it there because it is getting late. It's 10:30 as we're recording and I'm starting to fade. So, let's wrap it up for this week. And next week, we may be coming from a whole new town. I mean, definitely. No, we won't be in Plymouth anymore. So, anyway, we want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Kim L., Laura M., Matthew B., Sailing L., and Amy Z. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. We'd love to hear from you. Any feedback from you on our discussion? You can comment at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And we'll have links from our discussion to any things we talked about in our show notes at sqpn.com. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.